Sutray went up the river path, through Doc Bloom and Wild Onion, to the old floating roadhouse and tapped a last sad time at the green door. He rested on the railing, and he tapped again, but no one came. After a while, he descended the plank walk and crossed the fields and the tracks to the store.
"She's moved out," said Howard Clevenger.
"Yes," said Sutray.
"She had a brother in Mascot. I think she went to live with them. Did that woman find you that was hunting you?"
"She did."
"I seen you over there."
Sutray went back out and crossed to the river and sat on a stone and watched the water pass for a long time. It was just dusk. Hung in the darker wall of the hillside among kudzu and dusty vines, a few pale window lights. The porch at Jimmy Smith's with its yellow light and half-shadowed drinkers above the slat-railed balustrade. A broken portico, not unlike the shorn wreckage in McAnally, save pasted up with these small, crazed faces peering out. Over the squalid littoral, the waste-clogged river, and the immense emptiness of the world beyond. A garish figure was coming along, a hoyden that sallied and fluttered through the one cone of uncashiered lamplight down all Front Street, tripping through the dew in harlequin evening wear. They half-circled, regarding one another.
"Well, I see you're still around anyway," said Sutray.
"Honey, I'm always here. They can't do without me."
He smiled, prim-lipped and coyly. "Where's your hat this evening?"
"Oh, honey, hats are out. They just are. I always thought they were tacky anyway, except mine, of course."
He knit his hands and rolled his shoulders, and a whinny of girlish laughter went skittering among the little gray shacks and along the quiet twilit riverfront. He sobered suddenly and cocked his head.
"Where you been?"
he said. "I was in the hospital. Typhoid fever."
"Lord, honey, I thought you looked peaky. Let me see you."
He turned Sutray toward the street lamp and peered into his eyes with genuine solicitude.
"I'm okay," Sutray said.
"Sweetie, you have just fell off to skin and bones."
"I lost about 20 pounds. I've gotten some of it back."
"You want to rest and take care of yourself, you hear?"
Sutray held out his hand. "Tell me goodbye," he said.
"Where you going?"
"I don't know. I'm leaving Knoxville."
"Shoot,"
he slapped at Sutray's outstretched hand.
"You ain't going no place. When you going?"
"Right now. I'm gone." The black reached out sadly, his face pinched. They stood there holding hands in the middle of the little street.
"When you coming back?"
"I don't guess I'll be back."
"Don't tell me that."
"Well, sometime maybe. Take care."
"Honey, you write and let me know how you getting on."
"Well,
just a postcard."
"Okay."
"You need any money?"
"No, I've got some."
"You sure?"
"I'm okay." Tripping through the dew, squeezed his hand and stepped back and gave a sort of crazy little salute.
"Best luck in the world, baby,"
he said. "Thanks, John. You too." He lifted the hand and turned and went on. He had divested himself of a little cloaked godlet and his other amulets in a place where they would not be found in his lifetime, and he'd taken for talisman the simple human heart within him. Walking down the little street for the last time, he felt everything fall away from him, until there was nothing left of him to shed. It was all gone. No trail, no track. The spoor petered out down there on Front Street, where things he'd been lay like paper shadows. A few here, they thin out. After that, nothing. A few rumors. Idle word on the wind. Old news, years in traveling, that you could not put stock in. He took the shortcut up the path behind the houses, avoiding any chance of other meetings in the street. Old broken Thersites would have called down from his high window, but he was not well these latter days. Dried vitriol hung in glazen strings from a bush by the side of the house, and Sutray even thought he heard muted sounds of grousing in an upper room. He cocked one eye up the high, warped, clapboard wall to the chamber kept by this old, taper-headed troll, but no one watched back. The eunuch was asleep in his chair, and he stirred and mumbled fitfully, as if the departing steps of the fisherman depleted his dreams, but he did not wake. The city ambulance swung down off Front Street and went bobbling over the ground and across the tracks and up the river path until it came to the houseboat. People were watching along the porches, and there were people standing around in front of the store, watching with grave faces. Two men went in with a canvas stretcher and a blanket, and in a few minutes they came out with the body and slid it quickly into the rear of the ambulance. In backing around, they got the ambulance stuck in the mud. One wheel shot reams of gouty mire out into the river. The men climbed down and looked. One pushed. The ambulance sank until it was resting on its differential carrier. After a while, three tall colored boys in track shoes came along and pushed the ambulance out.
"Who's sick?" one said. "There was a man dead in there," a driver said.
They looked at each other.
"How long he been dead?"
"A couple of weeks."
"Shoo,"
one said, wrinkling his wide nose.
"That's what that's been."
"You don't know who it was, do you?"
"No, sir."
"Don't know who lived here?"
"No, sir."
"Come on, Ramsey. We gotta go."
"I hear you, man."
The driver closed the door and motioned with his hand, and the ambulance pulled away. The boys watched them go.
"Shit," one said. "Old Sutry ain't dead."
He had a small cardboard suitcase, and he came out of the weeds and set it on the edge of the road and straightened up and began combing his hair. He looked about his appearance, propping one foot on the case and bending to scrape beggar lice from his trousers with his thumbnail. New trousers of tan chino, a new shirt open at the neck. His face and arms were suntanned and his hair crudely barbered, and he wore cheap new brown leather shoes, the toes of which he dusted, one, the other, against the back of his trouser legs. He looked like someone just out of the army or jail. A car came down the highway, and he gestured at it with his thumb, and it went on. Traffic was slow along the road, and he was there a long time. It was very hot. You could see his skin through the new shirt. Across the road, a construction gang was at work, and he watched them. A backhoe was dragging out a ditch, and a caterpillar was going along the bank with mounds of pale clay shaling across its canted blade. Carpenters were hammering up forms, and a cement truck waited on with its drum slowly clanking. Sutry watched this industry accomplish itself in the hot afternoon. Downwind, light ochre dust had sifted all along the greening roadside foliage, and in the quiet mid-afternoon the call of a long, sad train horn floated over the lonely countryside. A boy was going along the works with a pail, and he leaned to each, ladling out water in a tin dipper. Sutry saw hands come up from below the rim of the pit in parched supplication. When all these had been attended, the boy came down along the edge of the ditch and handed up the dipper to the backhoe operator. Sutry saw him take it and tilt his head and drink and flick the last drops toward the earth and lean down and restore the dipper to the water carrier. They nodded to each other, and the boy turned and looked toward the road. Then he was coming down across the clay and over the ruts and laddered tracks of machinery. His dusty boots left prints along the black macadam, and he came up to Sutry, where he stood by the roadside and swung the bucket around and brought the dipper up all bright and dripping and offered it. Sutry could see the water beating coldly on the tin and running in tiny rivulets and drops that steamed on the road where they fell. He could see the pale gold hair that lay along the sunburned arms of the water-bearer like new wheat, and he beheld himself in wells of smoking cobalt, twinned and dark and deep in child's eyes, blue eyes, with no bottoms, like the sea. He took the dipper and drank and gave it back. The boy dropped it into the bucket. Sutry wiped his mouth on the back of his hand. "Thanks," he said. The boy smiled and stepped back. A car had stopped for Sutry. He'd not lifted a hand.
"Let's go," said the driver.
"Hello," said Sutry, climbing in, shutting the door, his suitcase between his knees. Then they were moving. Out across the land, the light wires and road rails were going, and the telephone lines with voices shuttling on like souls. Behind him, the city lay smoking, the sad Perlius of the dead immured with the bones of friends and forebears. Off to the right side, the white concrete of the expressway gleamed in the sun, where the ramp curved out into empty air and hung truncate with iron rods bristling among the vectors of nowhere. When he looked back, the water boy was gone. An enormous, lank hound had come out of the meadow by the river, like a hound from the depths, and was sniffing at the spot where Sutri had stood. Somewhere in the gray wood by the river is the huntsman, and in the brooming corn, and in the castellated press of cities. His work lies allwheres, and his hounds tire not. I have seen them in a dream, slaverous and wild, and their eyes crazed with ravening for souls in this world. Fly them. End of Sutri by Cormac McCarthy.